All right. Well, welcome, everybody. This is Mark Reynolds. You are on the June Citizens Climate Lobby International call. Let me just say at the start that for next month's call, we do not try and fight with the 4th of July, so we will not have a call on July 6th. Our next call will be on Saturday, the 13th of July. So if you call on July 6th, we will not be there, but we will be there on the July 13th. So I wanted to give everybody a heads up that July is one of those different kinds of months where it's different than everything else, because we do not, if the 4th of July falls, you know, close enough to the weekend, we don't try and fight with that. So a little over 5 years ago was the first time I was on one of these calls. And Marshall had told me it was going to be different than anything that I ever listened in on, and I skeptically thought that might be true. So I listened in on a call, and the first thing that happened is an economist talked about dealing with the issue of global warming from an economic point of view and using market forces to deal with it. And I was somewhat flabbergasted. It sounded like one of the most interesting things I'd heard, and certainly not an approach that I'd thought of how you could deal with something as big as climate change and global warming as an economic or market-based issue. So I was kind of stunned a little over 5 years ago listening on the call that I was educated on something that I hadn't been educated on. But then right after that, they did something where they had this short talk called a laser talk. And that knocked me over. I just didn't think you could take on educating people and then training people so that they could speak more effectively on the issue. So at this point, I was astounded. I thought this was a call that I, you know, just told Marshall I'd listen in on because we'd been friends for a long time and maybe we would be interesting. But the first two parts I thought were really good. And then the third part of the call was people said that they would get into action. And I was stupefied at that point. How could you educate people, train them how to speak, and then have people get into action in an hour or a bit over an hour? Obviously, I was taken in because I haven't gone anywhere for the last 5.5 years since I was on that first call, and we haven't seen any reason to change that formula. So what's going to be happening is in just a couple of minutes, I want to introduce our speaker, Dr. Lauren Rafalski, who was originally trained at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, who now works at Caltech. We had originally planned this call almost exclusively as a training call, and we're going to spend a little more time on training than we usually do on this call. But because there was a significant milestone since last month's call of the ppm of CO2 in the atmosphere hit 400, or at least we think it hit 400, it was really important for us to get an expert in that area to speak about that and what are the ramifications of it and how do we know if that's the case or not. So we'll be having Dr. Rafalski do that in just a moment. You know, we have some really interesting things that have happened in the field, and we'll be hearing from specific people throughout the U.S. and Canada about what's happening. We'll get a quick update on the conference. We're actually, rather than going over one laser talk, we're going to try and do at least four, maybe more on today's call, so that we can do more training than usual. You know, lots of times it's good to have deadlines because deadlines force us to get things done that we always wanted to get done. So connected to this month's action sheet are over 20 laser talks. And what we're going to ask everybody to do is between now and the June conference, whether or not you're coming to the conference, to work on those talks. So you could say, yeah, for the people coming to the conference, they should want to understand and be able to at least say those talks a couple of times to be ready for the conference. But really, it would be good for all of us to use it as a deadline and say, you know what, I'm going to do what I can to get myself ready to speak to the various different components of climate change. And then we'll also get into action this month. I think also that many of you on the call, in fact, I'm certain of it, saw the piece in the New York Times this week that was very kind to Citizens Climate Lobby. And I don't know if you've been checking the comments section, but so far there are at least 280 comments on that article on the Times website, 280 comments from Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers about that article. So Ellie Sparks sent me a few of those to read to you. I said I wanted to read all 280, but she said I could only read three, so she picked out three. So let me just tell you a couple of the things that people said back to the New York Times in response to that article. This is Peter in Houston. He said, excellent article and spot on. He said, CCL's success is in its ability to engage rather than alienate parties in this effort, from liberals to Tea Partiers, environmental activists to oil companies. CCL approaches everyone with respect and a willingness to listen. Thank you for the great article. I'm immensely proud to be a part of CCL and feel strongly that this organization will be a major player in passing climate legislation because I see every day the passion and hard work of the CCL volunteers put into this issue. Our secret weapon, we will get this done. Then this is from Mark Tabbert in Newport Beach. He says, I've been involved with nonprofit efforts for over 2 decades, and there's nothing like CCL. I lunched yesterday with Congressman Ed Royce, Republican of California, and was able to represent my cause effectively, not because of any special talent I have. I've just followed instructions for the last 8 months and put in the time to understand the issue. Love that comment from you, Mark. And then last one, Ricky from Dallas. Ricky says, CCL pushes its volunteers to step outside of their comfort zone, whether that be writing letters to the editor, facilitating outreach, or meetings with editorial boards or members of Congress, but only after we've been prepared for the task. What drew me to CCL is that it's nonpartisan and that we're fighting to bring everyone together to fight for something rather than being against something, which naturally pits one side against the other. I think any of you would be have a great time reading through some of these comments, and we're capturing them as they come along. And again, Ellie said I could read 3 of them, not the 280 that I wanted to read. Okay, so before we get to reports from the field and the laser talk, Dr. Lauren Rafalski, I really, really appreciate you making yourself available today, because I know we'd initially said we were going to do this call really oriented almost exclusively to training, but you did most of your training in the Keeling Lab at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and probably know as much about it as anybody we could talk to. So what we wanted to do is hear a little bit from you today about the Keeling Lab, its origin, what you're measuring, and how you're going about measuring it. So would you mind just starting with, where did that lab come from, and what is it exactly you're measuring, and how do you take worldwide measurements? So first of all, welcome Dr. Lauren Rafalski.
Thanks, I'm happy to be here. So the Keeling Lab is measuring global concentrations of atmospheric carbon dioxide. The measurements started in 1958 at Mauna Loa, which is a volcano in Hawaii. And over the last 55 years, we've seen a large increase in CO2 concentrations from around 315 to now around 400 parts per million. And I think the story of the origin of the lab is pretty interesting because the founder of the lab didn't originally set out to measure atmospheric carbon dioxide. Charles David Keeling, known as Dave to his friends, was the founder of the lab. And in the early 50s, he had just gotten his PhD, and he moved to California to work at Caltech. So he might have been in the very building that I'm calling from today. I'm not sure exactly. But he wanted to understand the concentrations of dissolved carbon dioxide in surface water and groundwater. And to do this, he needed a very precise measurement of atmospheric CO2 concentration. Up until this point, people didn't have a very good idea of exactly how much CO2 was in the atmosphere. So Keeling developed a new measurement technique which could measure CO2 more precisely. To take a measurement, he first had to get a sample by filling a glass flask with air. And he was worried that if he filled a flask with air, he would contaminate the sample with the carbon dioxide in his own breath. So the way he would take a sample is he would run into the wind, hold his breath, and open the valve on the flask. And this technique actually worked great for keeping the carbon dioxide in his breath out of the sample. He started taking measurements in Big Sur, California, which is a beautiful state park along the coast north of here. And he took measurements every few hours over a day and night just because he wanted to see what the CO2 concentration was and how it was changing over a day. And I'd like to share with you a quote from his autobiography, which I think gives some insight into his personality and his approach to science. He says, "Why did I devise such an elaborate sampling strategy when my experiment didn't really require it? The reason was simply that I was having fun. I like designing and assembling equipment. I didn't feel under any pressure to produce a final result in a short time. At the age of 27, the prospect of spending more time at Big Sur State Park to take sweeps of air and water samples instead of just a few didn't seem objectionable, even if I had to get out of a sleeping bag several times in the night. I saw myself carving out a new career in geochemistry. So Dave Keeling did what he did because he was having fun. He was having so much fun that he traveled around Western America to take similar measurements, and he found that wherever he went, CO2 concentrations were around 310 parts per million. And this was actually a very significant finding at the time because people didn't think that CO2 concentrations should be the same in different places. So he ended up becoming more interested in these atmospheric measurements than in his original project. And in 1956, he moved to the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And in 1958, he started up the measurement program at Mauna Loa in Hawaii. And over the years, the program has expanded to include many more research stations around the world. And today, the program is run by his son, Ralph Keeling, and that's who I worked with for my PhD at Scripps. In terms of how the measurements are taken, as I said, there are several stations around the world. The locations are from Greenland to the South Pole, and most of the stations are at very remote locations, like islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And there are really two types of measurements that are taken. I mentioned that when Keeling started taking measurements, he collected the air in a flask to be measured. That's still done today with some of the original flasks that Keeling used in the 50s. And the air is then measured in a lab at Scripps. In addition to these flask measurements, in some places measurements are also made what we call in situ, which means that the air is pumped directly into the instrument that does the analysis, which means you can get more frequent measurements. So most of the stations around the world only collect the flask samples, and only a couple do the in situ measurements.
Lauren, I imagine most of them don't do it the way he originally did, which you said, which is by running backwards to make sure that his breath doesn't go into the flask.
Right. Yeah, I think they have more sophisticated techniques now. But it's interesting because scientists are still concerned about contamination. They want to measure what's called the background air, so they want to make sure that they're not getting local sources of carbon dioxide, like car exhaust, in the samples. So they definitely take measures to make sure that they're not contaminating the samples. For example, one of the sampling sites is at Scripps, and it's right on the Pacific Ocean in San Diego, California. And when they want to fill a flask of air, they first check the wind direction, and they'll only take a sample if the wind is coming from the ocean, because if the wind were coming from the land, you'd see higher CO2 levels just from all the car exhaust and industrial emissions in San Diego. So all these stations have procedures like that to make sure that they're not contaminating the samples. And then the flasks are filled with air, they're shipped to Scripps, and then at Scripps they measure the CO2 concentration.
Great. Okay. And then, so recently we saw all kinds of reports about hitting 400 parts per million throughout the world, and then we said, oh no, maybe we didn't hit it. And so first of all, you know, in the scientific process, how do we know when we really hit it? I know that scientists are constantly really reevaluating the data to make sure it's accurate. So did we hit 400? And if we did or didn't, how will we know that we for sure we did or didn't?
Yeah, so the original 400 parts per million value early in the month, I think the next day they said, oh, it was actually, 399.8 or something like that. I think since then there have been updates to the measurements, and I think we have hit 400 parts per million since then. But really what happened originally when they changed the measurement is a really common occurrence, and I don't know specifically why they updated it. That measurement was actually from NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and not from Scripps. And so I don't know specifically what their technique is, but in general, what you do is you measure a sample with an unknown amount of carbon dioxide, and the instrument will give you a number, but you need to know what this number means, and you do this by what we call calibrating the instrument. So to calibrate the instrument, you have to measure gases where you already know what the CO2 concentration is. So you know what number you're supposed to get, and then you see if your measurement agrees with what you think you should get. So they have these suites of calibration gases that they run over and over again. Some might be run every hour, some are run every day, and some might just be run a few times a year. So you're measuring the same gases over and over again, so you can look for what we call drift in the instrument, which basically means is the instrument operating the way it was a week ago or a year ago or even 10 years ago, and then you can correct for any small changes over time. So by using these calibration gases, we can ensure that the measurement that's being reported is the real measurement because we're comparing it to something where we know the concentration. So it's possible that the correction that we saw earlier in the month, even though I don't know exactly what happened, it's possible that they took the measurement and then measured some of these calibration gases and found that they had to make a small correction in the measurement. And this sort of thing is so common that on NOAA's website and Scripps's Keeling Curve website, they have disclaimers that all the data from the past year are considered preliminary. So they're really, you know, as they take these calibration gases throughout the year, they'll update their previous measurements. But I think it's really important to point out that small corrections like this don't change the general results that atmospheric CO2 is rising rapidly and that the current levels are at or very near 400 parts per million.
Got it. Okay. But then what about there is some standard fluctuation that happens annually. And can you just say a little bit about the difference between what the source of annual fluctuation and then the difference between that and the steady rise of CO2 over time?
Yeah. So at Mauna Loa, carbon dioxide is actually 6 parts per million higher in the winter than in the summer. And the reason for this is that during the summer, you have all the plants growing, and so they absorb a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And then during the winter, these plants die and decompose, and then the carbon dioxide is released back to the atmosphere. So these fluctuations, I like to think of that they show the Earth breathing. It's a natural fluctuation during the year. And usually the maximum value is around May or June. So even though we're around 400 parts per million now, the CO2 concentration will start to decrease in the next couple months. So if you're following the daily CO2 concentration or if you hear in the news that CO2 is decreasing all of a sudden, you should remember that a drop in the summer is expected and it's completely normal. It's part of a natural cycle. On the other hand, we also have a steady rise year to year. That's around 2 parts per million per year, and this is caused by human activities that are releasing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere.
Cool. Okay, then I have one other thing I want to ask you, and then I wanted you to say anything else that you'd like to say about your work. So one of the things that is relatively mysterious for me, being a non-scientist not working in the scientific world, is how is your kind of work funded? So you worked in the Keeling Lab, and where does the Keeling Lab get its funding?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in general, labs at universities, like the Keeling Lab, are funded by federal agencies like the National Science Foundation. Sometimes labs also get private funding from donors or from companies, but usually most of the funding comes from federal sources. So scientists who run labs usually have to spend a significant percentage of their time writing grant applications to get funding to pay the salaries of everyone working in the lab and to pay for all their equipment. And usually these grants only last for around 2 to 3 years, and there's never a guarantee that the next grant will get funded, so they have to continuously apply for these grants to keep their programs going. So we take it for granted now that we have a 55-year record of atmospheric CO2, but this was far from certain when the measurements started, because you have to keep applying for these grants. In the 60s, the program was almost discontinued completely because there were budget cuts in the government. And in the 1970s and 80s, there was funding uncertainty because NOAA had just started taking their own measurements, and some of the funding agencies thought that NOAA should just take over the CO2 measurements. So really, over the past 55 years, Charles David Keeling and now Ralph Keeling have been very persistent in convincing people that the work that Scripps is doing is worth funding. They've done this in part by continuously finding new ways to use the data to learn even more about how carbon dioxide exchanges between the atmosphere and the land and the atmosphere and the ocean. These sorts of exchanges, understanding these processes will help us understand how future carbon dioxide emissions will affect atmospheric concentration. So they've done an amazing job at keeping this program going, and even after 55 years of funding uncertainties, the program is still going today.
Wow. All right. Well, I appreciate that because, again, you know, I just assume, you know, the scientific world, the money comes from somewhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, as long as I don't have to take care of it, I'm not too worried about it. But it looks like someone has to be paying attention all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, good. Dr. Rafalski, anything else that you think would be relevant or useful for us about your work in the lab or what the lab's doing or you know, CO2 at this point?
You know, I think we've hit the main points. I think it's just important for everybody to know that, you know, if you hear things in the news about sort of uncertainties about the level, you know, are we at 400 parts per million or not, I think it's important to understand that 400 parts per million in itself doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't mean that suddenly systems in the Earth are going to start changing. It's sort of just like an odometer on the car. It's a nice even number. And so people are paying attention. And so I think whether or not we're at exactly 400 parts per million is not the main point. The point is that carbon dioxide is still increasing. We're at the highest levels we've seen since we started measuring, and there's no sign that CO2 is starting to decrease in the long term.
Great. Okay. Well, again, we had originally planned to just have this call be a training call, but given we'd hit the 400 parts, we thought this was important. And, you know, I know I've told you how many times how lucky we feel to have you as part of the team. Just so those of you know, Lauren's been part of our, while she was working on her PhD, our team that's based in La Jolla, all of whom are graduate students at Scripps. And so, you know, Lauren's been in lobby sessions, led lobby sessions both in California and in Washington, D.C., and we're really, really lucky to have people like you as a part of the organization. So thank you so much, particularly for jumping in at the last minute to make this available to all of us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on the call today.
Great. All right. Okay, very nice. So we're going to get to more extensive laser talks than usual in just a moment, but I want to hear some specific, I want to tell you, hear from the field some of the things that people are out there making happen. So just so you can prepare yourself if you're about to do a report, first we're going to hear from Maria in Santa Fe, then we'll go to Salt Lake City, then we'll go to Madison, then we'll go to Kathy in Canada, then Dawn in Raleigh, and Ellie in Virginia. So before Maria talks, let me just say something about this. You know, one of the things that I go around a lot saying is we should be doing this and we should be doing that, even though I think that's a very strange word. Because what happens is people actually do what they do. They don't ever do what they should do. They do what they actually do. And so several years ago, I used to go around saying, we should have meetings with editorial boards. That's important. Somebody should do this. And then shortly before going to Boston to the Group START workshop, Gary Rosinski called me and said, I scheduled a meeting with the editorial board with the Boston Globe. And so my thought then was, goodness gracious, what are we going to do with them? But Gary transformed something we should do to something we are doing. And for anybody who's been part of this organization for any time, you know what a remarkable return on investment, you might say, that now 60 editorial board meetings later and the enormous work that's come from newspapers where we've met with them all started with somebody transforming a should into what's happening. You know, very similar to this is what Maria in Santa Fe did. I used to tell people all the time, you know, if you have a TV or a radio license, those stations, because they have a public license, are required to do public service announcements. But every time we tried to do something, but it didn't work out, and so I threw in the towel and said it's impossible. People are telling me the rules are too hard. Nobody can comply. But nevertheless, somebody turned a should into something that actually happened. So, Maria, if you could *6 your phone, that should unmute you. And if you could just say your name so that we can hear you. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me, Mark?
Yeah, Maria, go ahead.
Okay, so we just went and asked the radio station. Actually, we talked to their marketing person there, and they had some public ads that they do on their website for nonprofits. They have a list of nonprofits, so putting our name and our logo on their website was what I originally had planned. And then she mentioned that they had some PSAs, that they were spots for 30-second PSAs. If we were interested in them, they would give us that time for free. So I've got some people at my meeting today that heard the PSA, and they showed up at the meeting.
Great.
So
great.
Basically, we just asked, and we went down and recorded it, and we did it. And I found that, actually here, I found that the radio stations are easier to work with than the newspapers. I get calls from the radio stations that I've made contacts with all the time just saying, oh, you want to be on my show this week, or can you give me a 5-minute update on what you're doing? So we've had a lot of luck with the radio.
Wow. So something that we were making very complicated was very simple, as you asked for it and you got it.
Right. I think sometimes when we look at things as complicated, then they become more complicated than they are. And so it's just be bold, go out and do it, and, the worst they can say is no, but you can always find another angle.
Fantastic. All right, Maria, congratulations, and thank you so much for doing that. You know, the way things work around here. Once somebody does it, we're going to be hearing about this everywhere, but thank you for being the trailblazer.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Talk to you later.
Okay, great. Thanks, Maria.
Bye.
Okay, Salt Lake City. So again, you know, one of the things that we keep pushing and saying, you know, how important it is to include other experts in the community when you go have lobby meetings, and certainly in Utah, Representative Stewart has been saying some strange things. So, Dave, are you there in Salt Lake, or someone in the Salt Lake group that wants to represent the latest meeting with Representative Stewart's staff?
Yeah, I am, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there were some concerns raised about Representative Stewart. Representative Stewart is the chairman of the House Subcommittee for the Environment, so he'll be hearing all things about EPA and about climate change. And one of our volunteers, Kurt Williamson, took the initiative to invite Utah State Climatologist, Dr. Rob Gillies, and the University of Utah Department of Atmospheric Sciences Chair, Kevin Perry, to meeting with Representative Stewart's state director. And basically, Dr. Gillies and Dr. Perry took the lead on this and were very effective in discussing some of the inaccuracies that Representative Stewart had said and offered their willingness to be a resource for the representative also to answer any questions they might have on the science of climate change. And so Representative Aide was very interested and said he would mention this to Dr. Stewart to Representative Stewart the next week. So basically, we believe we've created an opening for a dialogue with this issue with Stewart's office. And we also have, due to the initiative of Kurt, a couple of well-known scientists who are willing to attend these meetings and be involved with us.
Great. That's just fantastic. Thank you so much for doing that. Again, somebody asked for something, and look what's happened, and now you've got another, two extremely credible partners in Utah. And I think not only the credibility of their voice being heard helps, but them also finding out that their, years and years of training themselves with expertise has a chance of paying off in ways maybe they didn't think could. Great. Thank you so much for that, Dave.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, good. Okay, so Madeline, let's get to another area of things we all think we should be doing, which is going out to town halls where members of Congress, of Parliament, are seen, and where you might be able to ask a question. Madeline? Madeline, are you there?
Can you hear me, Mark?
Yeah, now I can. There was a little echo, but now I can hear you.
Okay, great. Yeah, so a few weeks ago we learned that our congressman was going to have a series of listening sessions in the district. And these are open meetings where constituents can come and ask questions, and they seem to mostly happen in the small towns. So with just a little emailing and phone calling, and with the help of the Iowa County CCL chapter, we found people who live near all three sessions that our Democratic representative held on Tuesday, and we got somebody also to one session in a neighboring Republican district. So imagine Representative Pocan traveling outside Liberal Madison to a small farming community and getting asked about carbon fee and dividend in the morning, then traveling 50 miles away in the afternoon and getting asked about it again in another small town, and then on to another town in the late afternoon and getting a third question about it. That's what happened. And then the icing on the cake, according to a Wisconsin Public Radio news report on the listening session, which led off with the fact that climate change and carbon taxes were the top issue on the minds of Representative Pocan's constituents. So we're just all smiling here. So I'm betting that other people's members of Congress do something similar, and what you need to do is keep an eye on their website, particularly when they're going to be back in the district, and then you can find out when. Yeah. And the turnout at these meetings was low, like 8 to 20 people, so it's really pretty easy to get to ask a question and sometimes a follow-up. So like all you need is a couple of pleasant-looking people showing up with a question ready on climate change, and you can raise the profile of climate change for like the member of Congress and for the constituents that are present too. So I think even like our newest members can take that action and extend our reach out into areas where we might only have a single contact. So I hope people will try it.
Great. Madeline, thank you so much. So great. So fun. Excellent. Okay, good. Let's move up to Canada. Now, Kathy, you always tell us that the Canadian activists are the most polite activists we have. But nevertheless, they seem to take on some of the most outrageous things. So just give us one outrageous thing of the week. We don't need all 10 that happened, but I know that you've always said they're polite, but they seem to be doing really fun and interesting things. Are you there, Kathy?
Yes. Can you hear me, Mark?
Yep.
Okay, wonderful. So this happened on Tuesday, May 7th. Al Gore, Vice President Al Gore, was at a big event in Toronto with 1,200 people, and he was being interviewed by Canada's national newspaper, The Globe and Mail. And one of our volunteers in Toronto, Sharon Howarth, was giving out Citizens Climate Lobby handouts as people were walking in. And then she randomly got tickets to this sold-out event. And when Mr. Gore was all done speaking, she got to the microphone she didn't even get to the microphone. She got to one of the podiums to speak, didn't have a microphone, spoke really loudly about Citizens Climate Lobby. Certainly everybody heard her. And then, amongst other things, but Citizens Climate Lobby was in there. And then, when she was all done, when she walked to the stage to give Mr. Gore one of her handouts, she was stopped by Men in Black. And then Mr. Gore let her come to the front, and she hand delivered a pamphlet about Citizens Climate Lobby to Mr. Gore in front of 1,200 people. And afterwards, people came up to her and thanked her. And yeah, it was the most exciting story I'd read that day. And there were many this month. But thanks for letting me share that one.
Yep. And I love our polite Canadian volunteers are not stopped by Men in Black. All right, good. All right, let's go down to Raleigh. Donna Dew, you know, there's a piece that I'd like you to represent that, we don't pay as much attention to on this call as we could. I think sometimes people start new groups and we do the three-hour group training and people think, okay, that's cool. It'll be just like I hear on the call. There'll be 20 people in Toronto and 13 people in Seattle and 10 people in Atlanta and 20 people in Santa Fe. It'll just be like that. And then what happens is some people start the group and then they call in and they are it. So, Don, you're one of those people who started your group, initially didn't take off, but you stuck with it. So how did you stick with it over time and then eventually build your group when it was you by yourself for so long? So are you there, Don?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can. Can you speak a little bit louder?
Sure.
Go ahead.
So first, thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak today. When I first joined CCL 2 years ago, I was very excited to get a group started in North Carolina. And I found out very quickly that it was going to be a lot more difficult than I originally thought. I spent the first several months by myself in my living room listening to this call. And after a while, I really understood that people were far more likely to sign a petition than to actually take action and really make a difference on climate change. And so after about a year of a lot of trial and error on my part to find my niche and grow as a group leader, we really started to get more attendance at the meetings. We started getting letters published, and then it just snowballed into now what we have going here. And I attribute that to two main points. One is really focusing on new members when they first want to join the group, giving them the confidence that they are as important as the person who's been here, who started CCL. And they are the most exciting because they are just beginning to understand the political power that they have. And the second part is everyone has talents that they bring, whether it's writing or meeting, doing outreach. But the challenge for me is to find the talents that people have that they don't know they have. And that's all about the personal breakthroughs, and that's what grows each individual member and is what helps grow our group.
Great. Fabulous, Don. And again, I'm so inspired with people when they stick with it that first year when it's hard and it's them by themselves. It's easy to throw in the towel, but you never did that. You just hung in there. Great.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank Yeah, thank you so much. All right, Ellie Sparks in Farmville, Virginia. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so first of all, let me just say to everybody, I think, you know, if you've been on this call for any period of time, you know, Ellie's been one of our rock stars for some time, and one of the things that, you know, we occasionally need to do is add personnel, not because we're interested in being an organization of employees. We're very much interested in being an organization of volunteers. And the only time when we decide to add people is that if we have to be able to maintain the level of support for volunteers, where if people need feedback on a letter, whether people need input, preparation, help on getting ready for a meeting with a member of Congress, if they have questions on legislative or scientific information, and if we can't respond instantly, then we have to do work to expand our staffing. So anytime we do that, it's so that we can maintain the level of support for the staffing, and I think anybody who's been on this call knows that we wanted to add Ellie for a long time, and actually Wednesday was Ellie's first day as a Citizens Climate Lobby staff member. So first of all, Ellie, welcome. It is so great to have you actually being able to do this on a full-time basis.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay, so we want to pivot a little bit and start talking just a little bit about the conference. We've mostly been talking about, you know, Dr. Hansen's going to be there, Dr. Sheeling Sue's going to be there, but there's also going to be 15 breakout sessions. And Ellie, the session you're going to be leading is on what?
Building relationships with editorial boards and members of Congress and Parliament.
Okay, so in terms of building relationships with editorial boards, you, Monica, Bill, Richard have met with the editorial board or communicated with them in Richmond how many times?
Well, we've had 2 formal meetings with them, and then we've dropped by informally 7 times. We've sent 27 emails to the head of the editorial department thanking him for specific things he's done. We've sent 51 thank you emails to the email address for letters to the editor. And these numbers don't even count the 137 regular letters to the editors that we've sent and 5 op-eds that we've submitted.
Great. And so you've done a lot of outreach after the very first meeting, and what's been the general outcome of that?
It's been very productive. It's been a relationship that is built up, a willingness to listen to us, an availability, and you know, these folks are stepping into their role, as I like to say, as climate hero.
Great. And so now you've used the exact same model of saying that we can use relationship as our access for building what we need to do for political will. The Richmond Times has been a huge success. But also you've done a lot of outreach with Eric Cantor. Now, I don't know how many people on this call are people who like to watch the political shows, but I do. And so it's been interesting to me that you have pursued Eric Cantor so aggressively because, you know, if you watch the political shows, he's often viewed as one of the people making the most kind of strident comments. And you've met with his office how many times now?
We've met 7 times with his office.
7 times with his office, and every single time you've asked his staff to do what?
We've asked for a meeting with the congressman.
You've asked for a meeting with it, and so 7 times they said no, right?
7 times, well, 6 times he said no. The 7th time he said yes, and we have a meeting set during the conference on Wednesday, June 26th at 11:30 a.m. in the congressman's Capitol office building. He's the majority leader, so he has a fancy office in the Capitol building, and our crew will be going to meet with him during the conference.
Great. And so on your session in the conference, you're going to be doing what then?
Well, we're going to be breaking down how it is that we've been able to do this in Virginia with this very hard-to-reach member of Congress. How do you build a relationship with a member of Congress or Parliament or an editorial board?
Beautiful. Okay, Ellie, thank you so much. We're excited about that, and congratulations. Having that meeting scheduled in a certain sense completely changes what we're doing at the conference because he's such an important possible leader on this issue.
That's right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All righty then, just a quick update on the rest of the conference. Amy Bennett, are you there?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
Yeah. So for whether people are coming to the conference or not, how many people are registered at this point?
Mark, we have 290 people registered for the conference this year.
So that's way more than 100 more than last year. And how many appointments are you booked right now?
To this date, we've got 243 meetings scheduled in D.C. for January 25th until we leave.
Okay, very nice.
June,
so last year we had 303. The target this year is?
535.
All right. And then in terms of preparation, Laura and her team has been working on the bio, says that all but 61 of the bios that have been assigned to the field are in. So thank you all for the incredible work you've been doing towards that. And, you know, to Laura, anytime you see Laura in Santa Monica or anybody in that Santa Monica group, we should all thank them because they will touch all 535 bios at some point and make sure they're in a one-page format. The really most crucial thing now, Amy, between now and the conference is for people to get the appointments confirmed, right?
Correct, Mark. And one of the things we want to remind people of is these offices get anywhere from 300 to 2,100 emails every day. So the chances are they're not going to have time to call us back. So we need to be persistent and polite and follow up with those offices because we do need to get all those appointments set up.
Great. Okay, good, good, good. All right, so we thank you so much for that, Amy. Did anything else happen this month besides a big push towards the conference?
Yes, we had 19 meetings with members of Congress and Parliament this month. We had 103 pieces published, 11 radio spots, and 58 outreach events.
Wow. Okay, pretty impressive. Amy, thank you so much. Would you go ahead and hand the phone to Danny? So we'll
do
the laser talks, and then we'll swing to Judy and Encinitas after Danny. So, Danny, are you there?
I'm handing it over to him right now, just a second.
Okay, good, okay. So what we're going to do in just a moment, everybody, first, Danny, we'll get you in just one second. So what we're going to do in just a moment, everybody, is we're going to go through at least four of the laser talks, and we're going to ask you to practice them there. So what's going to happen is Danny's going to read a laser talk. We're going to ask you to pair up in your meeting and take a maximum of 1 minute each to deliver as many points as you can from the laser talks. We'd like to get to four, and if we can get to more than four, great. If you're a group leader, we'd like you to monitor this so that when you hear us speaking again, you ask people to wrap up the talk, they're moving on, and move to the next one. Now, let's just be clear about how laser talks are designed. First of all, communication never happens in a vacuum. And when we're communicating on this issue, if you said that there was an argument for something and against something, we're always in the argument in favor of moving something forward, of making something happen. And if you said that there was an opposite argument, that argument is often designed to just stop things. So it used to be that people would argue that the science wasn't settled because that ended the discussion. But we've resolved that, but we continue to train ourselves to move forward on that issue. It used to be that people would try and push back with us and say that if we went to a green economy, that would be a job killer. We can't let that end the discussion. So a couple of talks that we'll be working on in a minute are about what a huge possible boost this is to jobs. But now oftentimes what people say now is, well, it doesn't matter what the U.S. does because China's such a mess. Well, we can't have that just knock us over. So what we're always doing is designing our talks to keep a discussion moving forward. And in some cases, it's to give people arguments that they may not have had about why they could take action on climate change. For instance, we will go through a faith-based argument. So first of all, Danny, let me just say that I think a lot of people who are on this call know that Danny joined our staff about a month ago, that yesterday he finally got the final sign-off on his dissertation. So I guess we can now formally call you Dr. Richter. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, great. Well then, Dr. Richter, which is the first laser talk you're going to read? Can you tell people what number would be on their list and then go ahead and read it?
The first laser talk that I'm going to read is number 5, and the title is Jobs, Fossil Fuels versus Renewables.
Okay, go ahead.
In 2010, there were a total of 174,000 permanent coal-related jobs nationwide and 806,831 oil and gas jobs as of 2011. By contrast, there were 3,129,112 green jobs in 2010. The Department of Energy predicts using conservative estimates that by 2030, there will be over 500,000 wind jobs alone. The overall job story is that renewable energy will provide more and higher paying jobs with more diverse opportunities. This is because $1 million worth of oil and natural gas output directly creates 0.8 jobs. and $1 million of coal produces 1.9 jobs. Compare that to building retrofits for energy efficiency, 7 jobs per million, mass transit services, 11 jobs, building the smart grid, 4.3, wind, 4.6, solar, 5.4, and biomass power generation, 7.4. The green economy already supports more jobs than the fossil fuel economy and has for years, even though renewable energy accounts for only 13.2% of our domestically produced energy. Coal, oil, and gas, and the pipelines to transport them, do not produce or support jobs. The green economy produces and supports jobs and will for years to come.
Okay, so what we're going to ask you to do in the city where you are is pair up now, and we're going to give you about, 45 seconds to a minute each to deliver any key points. You don't have to do the whole talk. Just communicate any key points you can do, and then you'll hear us yell in about 2 minutes, and that will be group leaders pay attention, time to go to the next talk. So go ahead and start practicing that talk. Pick a partner. Have one person go first, and each of you deliver some key points from that talk. Go ahead and do that in the cities around the U.S. and Canada. Okay, group leaders, you should have people switch if they haven't switched roles yet. Okay, group leaders, go ahead and ask people to wrap that up. Obviously, they could take more time on that one. They could spend more time on it. But if you would ask everybody to wrap that one up, we're going to do the next one in just a moment. One of the things we're going to ask everybody to do, you'll see on the action sheet, one of the actions is we're going to ask people to practice the laser talks. We are strongly recommending that you actually get together sometime in the next month to practice the laser talks because it's almost of no value just to read them. You don't hear what you say well until you say it out loud a bunch of times. So part of the thing about practice is not only beginning to see how you like to say it, but when you say it enough times, so you begin to look over at the person you're speaking with and see if you're actually connecting with them. Because the crucial thing isn't, do you say it in some great way? It's, does it actually connect with the other person? And the only way that you know you've done that is to practice enough so you can see someone else's response. Okay, Dr. Richter, what's the second talk we're going to do?
Second talk is number 6, border tax adjustment / protecting our manufacturing jobs.
Okay.
All right. In order for a fee on carbon to work domestically and on an international scale, an effective border tax adjustment will be necessary. Joost Paulellen worked as a legal advisor for the WTO Secretariat from 1996 to 2002, and in international legal circles is widely considered to be among the world's foremost World Trade Organization experts. From Geneva, Mr. Paulellen assured us that a border tax adjustment is viable. As a backup, even if a quote-unquote border adjustment was found to be discriminatory, the resulting violation may still be justified by the environmental exceptions. Thus, a carbon tax would be double covered. Having a border adjustment is important because it makes sure that domestic manufacturers are not put at a competitive disadvantage, and it will ensure that if countries like India and China want to keep using dirty manufacturing processes, they will have to pay the U.S. government for the privilege.
Okay, in your city around the U.S. again, Canada again, whoever went first last time, go. The other person go first this time. Please go ahead and deliver any key points you can from that talk. Please go ahead. Okay, please have them switch group leaders if they haven't yet. Okay, and if you could just ask people to wrap that one up. I know we're covering a lot of material quickly, but we want to begin to get a taste of these and then actually see from doing a quick taste what are the ones that we need to spend more time on. Very nice. Danny, what's the next one we're going to do?
The next one is number 11, Faith-Based Groups Call on Us to Be Stewards of the Planet and Act on Climate Change. And this one is long. We have a lot of examples. I'm only going to read three of those examples. So this one reads, the world's major faith groups and religious leaders have all made powerful statements on the climate. They say that climate change is real, that the burning of fossil fuels is causing it, and that we humans have a moral responsibility to take action to correct it. These groups include Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists, as well as many indigenous peoples such as the Hopi Indians. From the Vatican, this quote, reduce worldwide carbon dioxide emissions without delay using all means possible. The cost of doing this pales in comparison to the price the world will pay if we fail to act now. From the Evangelical Climate Initiative, human-induced climate change is real and increasing international instability, which could lead to more security threats to our nation. In the United States, the most important immediate step that can be taken at the federal level is to pass and implement national legislation requiring sufficient economy-wide reductions in carbon dioxide emissions through cost-effective market-based mechanisms such as a cap-and-trade program. From the Southern Baptists, in the face of intense concern and guided by the biblical principle of creation stewardship, we resolve to engage this issue without any further lingering over the basic reality of the problem or our responsibility to address it. Humans must be proactive and take responsibility for our contributions to climate change, however great or small.
Great. Okay, go ahead, pair up, and again, take about 45 seconds each from each side. If you could just say, make a general statement and then speak to one faith-based organization, that would probably be good for this exercise. Go ahead. Okay, and switch if you haven't switched roles yet. Okay, go ahead and wrap that one up. And Danny, what's the last one we're going to do today?
The last one that we're going to do today is number 18, China One. Does it matter what we do?
Good.
And this reads, we should not have any illusions about China's energy use. This one country with 1.3 billion people to our 0.3 billion accounts for almost half of the world's coal consumption and growing fast. Yet, it is also suffering horrible environmental impacts because of this. At the same time, China is also investing heavily in renewables. Last year, they invested $65 billion to our $35 billion. Today, they produce more than half of all solar panels, and in 2012 installed more solar panels than any country except Germany. What's more, they've debuted a regional cap-and-trade program that they plan on linking with Australia and also plan to institute a carbon tax by 2015 or 16. Because of all this investment in renewables, we risk losing out on jobs, profits, and production of renewable energy hardware to China. Because of our underinvestment, ideas that are born in the U.S. become reality in China. The products on those realized ideas are then manufactured in China and sold to the U.S., with the majority of jobs and profits staying in China, not in the U.S. This is why we should do all that we can to move away from fossil fuels as fast as we can. China's all in, and our economy will suffer for it.
Okay, one of the things you'll notice from looking at the laser talks is all of the references are embedded in these talks. So if you wanted to know where all of the information came from, the points we're making, the references are there. And also, if anybody asked you, whether it was a member of Congress, Parliament, or the media, you can always tell them the source of the information. And these are credible sources from which we're pulling information you'll see by looking at them. Okay, go ahead. Last laser talk that you're going to be doing during the call. Go ahead and pair up. The person who's going first, you got 45 seconds. Go ahead. Okay, switch if you haven't switched. Okay, good. And if you could go ahead and wrap up around the cities of in Canada and U.S., thank you so much. Any additional practice you do today would be fantastic. I think you can see that the very first two laser talks are just the basic, you know, carbon fee and talk, our basic elevator talk. I would ignore the last bullet there about 4 million jobs. That was embedded from another laser talk, but everything else I would keep. And then just the basic science. So anything you can do to practice all those talks. And again, the talks are designed because communication does not happen in a vacuum. It happens in relationship to people. I've had a chance to do a lot of the group starts where we've actually practiced a meeting with a member of Congress. And one of the issues that is there as a laser talk that we have to be prepared for is in many, many, many offices that you go to, if you talk about developing clean sources of energy, one of the first things they're going to bring up is nuclear power. And if we can deal with that as rational, informed people, it's really crucial to moving the discussion along. If we lose our minds and we say, didn't you pay attention, didn't you see Fukushima, everything ends. So I'm not asking you to say whether you're for or against. I think most people on this call are against nuclear power, and you should say that. But in addition to that, you should be able to state that people like Jim Hansen are for it. The National Academy of Sciences says it's safe. So we should be able to deal with those kinds of issues where they relate to us as an expert, as an informed person, not just a committed activist. Our being committed activists is crucial, but being informed is important as our passion. Okay, very good. So then what's going to happen is there's two things we're asking people to do. Judy, I know I still have you. You'll be there in 30 seconds. There's two things we're asking everybody to do this month. One is to practice the laser talks. And if everybody could use the deadline of the conference, whether you're attending or not, more people won't be attending the conference than will be attending it. But if we could use that, we would say by the month of June, every one of us had at least tried to get our head around these talks, maybe said it to the mirror one time, maybe said it to one person. I know that some of you could deliver all these talks right now and be confident about it, but all of us should be working this month to expand our ability to be fluent of the many, many issues that we need to speak to solve the big problem that we're working on. And then the second action we're asking people to take is actually to do the local research. So I must agree with the speaker from last month, Senator Whitehouse, talking about how important the local impacts are. So we gave you a bunch of resources and links you could use to identify what are the local impacts on the economy, on farming, you know, every way that we, on weather, so we could look at this so that we are very much localizing our response. That's the one thing we cannot do from headquarters is we can't do the research on your community, and certainly if you could delegate that and as many people take it on as possible would be fantastic. Okay, Judy in Encinitas, could you unmute your phone for just 1 second?
Can you hear me, Mark?
I can, Judy, and I just want to make sure, you know, the initiative that you set up to let people help fund the conference is still open and people could still participate if they wanted, right?
That's it. Okay.
That's it?
Here we go. So everyone who's out there, I want to thank those of you who've donated to the Indiegogo campaign that we have to raise money for the conference. It's really wonderful, and there's 14 days left. So those of you who have not donated, you still can. Mark mentioned the New York Times article earlier in the call and how great that was. When I read it, I was really proud to be a part of this group, and it also gave me a new way of sharing CCL with my friends. So I encourage you to use that article as a way to tell people about CCL, and if they don't have time to donate, they might have money to donate, and you can direct them to the Indiegogo campaign. The link is on the front of the monthly action sheet. And then finally, I just want to say, my husband, Dodd, and I, we have 2 children. One is 21 and one is 24. And our son gave a month ago when we first put Indiegogo up, and we were really proud of him. And we've been volunteering with CCL for almost 4 years now. And I have to say, our 24-year-old daughter, she probably doesn't even know what CCL stands for. But with that said, when she asked me what I wanted for Mother's Day, I told her that I wanted her to use her artistic talent and her understanding of social media to help me popularize the Indiegogo campaign. So whether you like Facebook or you hate Facebook, on Monday, if you go to the CCL Facebook page Monday through Thursday, you'll see her efforts in action. And so I encourage you, when you hang up from this call, to go look at your calendar, write down Monday morning, go to Facebook, and if what you see makes you smile, I hope you'll share it with your friends. Thanks, Mark.
Okay, Judy, thank you so much. I just think it's so... it's just better when everything that happens is something initiated from the field, not from headquarters, and this has been entirely driven by the Encinitas group. Okay, so 2 last things, everybody. So we're not doing something complicated here. We are not having to, build some building. We're not having to land some space rover on Mars like part of the people in our Pasadena group do. We are managing a conversation, and how we do that is by finding access points to reach out to people. So whether that's out in a town hall like we heard about it, whether it's a public service announcement, whether it's the over 20 meetings that happen with members of Parliament or Congress, or once again, over 100 pieces published by Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers this month. That is simply reaching out and altering the discussion, the atmosphere, the conversation in which we will solve this problem. So then, as a reminder, in July, it's one of the few months where we change from the first Saturday because we don't try and deal with the 4th of July, so it'll be July the 13th. Thank you all. Thank you all for the practice that you did and for the practice you will do and for all of you you're doing. And let me also just say, as I said at the start of the call, 5.5 years ago when I first listened in on the call and I loved this formula of education, practice, and action. There were 6 groups. This month we went over 100. There's now 101 groups. So thank you all for the incredible outreach you're doing. We'll talk to y'all in July. Have a great month, everybody. Bye now.